Billy's arrival in the cab is narration, action, if you like that word better. What follows after he steps through the door of the restaurant is pretty much straight description. I got in almost all of the details which first came to mind when I accessed my memories of the real Palm 2, and I added a few other things as well. The maitre d' between shifts is pretty good, I think. I love the undone tie and the cuffs rolled up to expose the hairy wrists. It's like a photograph. The smell of fish is the only thing not here, and that's because the smell of the onions was stronger. We come back to actual storytelling with a bit of narration. The maitre d' steps forward to center stage, and then the dialogue. By now, we see our location clearly. There are plenty of details I could have added. The narrowness of the room, Tony Bennett on the sound system, the Yankees bumper sticker on the cash register. But what would be the point? When it comes to scene setting and all sorts of description, a meal is as good as a feast. We want to know if Billy has located Richie Martin. That's the story we paid our $24 to read. More about the restaurant would slow the pace of that story, perhaps annoying us enough to break the spell good fiction can weave. In many cases, when a reader puts a story aside because it got boring, the boredom arose because the writer grew enchanted with his powers of description and lost sight of his priority, which is to keep the ball rolling. If the reader wants to know more about Palm 2 than can be found above, he or she can either visit the next time he or she is in New York or send for a brochure. I've already spilled enough ink here for me to indicate Palm 2 will be a major setting for my story. If it turns out not to be, I'd do well to revise the descriptive stuff down by a few lines in the next draft. Certainly, I couldn't keep it in on the grounds that it's good. It should be good if I'm being paid to do it. What I'm not being paid to do is be self-indulgent. There is straight description, a few solitary drinkers at the bar, and a bit of rather more poetic description. The back bar mirror glimmered in the gloom like a mirage. In my central descriptive paragraph about Palm 2. Both are okay, but I like the figurative stuff. The use of simile and other figurative language is one of the chief delights of fiction, reading it and writing it as well. When it's on target, a simile delights us in much the same way meeting an old friend in a crowd of strangers does. By comparing two seemingly unrelated objects, a restaurant bar and a cave, a mirror in a mirage, we are sometimes able to see an old thing in a new and vivid way. Even if the result is mere clarity instead of beauty, I think writer and reader are participating together in a kind of miracle. Maybe that's drawing it a little strong, but yeah, it's what I believe. When a simile or metaphor doesn't work, the results are sometimes funny and sometimes embarrassing. Recently, I read this sentence in a forthcoming novel I prefer not to name. He sat stolidly beside the corpse, waiting for the medical examiner as patiently as a man waiting for a turkey sandwich. If there is a clarifying connection here, I wasn't able to make it. I consequently closed the book without reading further. If a writer knows what he or she is doing, I'll go along for the ride. If he or she doesn't, well, I'm in my 50s now, and there are a lot of books out there. I don't have time to waste with the poorly written ones. The Zen simile is only one potential pitfall of figurative language. The most common, and again, landing in this trap can usually be traced back to not enough reading, is the use of cliched similes, metaphors, and images. He ran like a madman. She was pretty as a summer day. The guy was a hot ticket. Bob fought like a tiger. Don't waste my time, or anyone's, with such chestnuts. It makes you look either lazy or ignorant. Neither description will do your reputation as a writer much good. My all-time favorite similes, by the way, come from the hard-boiled detective fiction of the 40s and 50s and the literary descendants of the dime dreadful writers. These favorites include "It was darker than a carload of assholes," George V. Higgins, and "I lit a cigarette that tasted like a plumber's handkerchief," Raymond Chandler. The key to good description begins with clear seeing and ends with clear writing, the kind of writing that employs fresh images and simple vocabulary. I began learning my lessons in this regard by reading Chandler, Hammett, and Ross Macdonald. I gained perhaps even more respect for the power of compact, descriptive language from reading T.S. Eliot, those ragged claws scuttling across the ocean floor, those coffee spoons, and William Carlos Williams, White Chickens, Red Wheelbarrow, The Plums That Were in the Icebox, so sweet and so cold. As with all other aspects of the narrative art, you will improve with practice, but practice will never make you perfect. Why should it? What fun would that be? And the harder you try to be clear and simple, the more you will learn about the complexity of our American dialect. It be slippery, precious. Aye, it be very slippery indeed. Practice the art, always reminding yourself that your job is to say what you see, and then get on with your story. Let us now talk a little bit about dialogue, the audio portion of our program. It's dialogue that gives your cast their voices, and it is crucial in defining their characters. Only what people do tells us more about what they're like, and talk is sneaky. What people say often conveys their character to others in ways of which they, the speakers, are completely unaware. You can tell me via straight narration that your main character, Mr. Butts, never did well in school, never even went much to school, but you can convey the same thing, and much more vividly, by his speech. And one of the cardinal rules of good fiction is never tell us a thing if you can show us instead. "What you reckon?" the boy asked. He doodled a stick in the dirt without looking up. What he drew could have been a ball, or a planet, or nothing but a circle. "You reckon the earth goes around the sun like they say?"
"I don't know what they say," Mr. Butts replied. "I ain't never studied what this'un or that'un says, because each'un says a different thing until your head is finally aching and you lose your ammonite."
"What's ammonite?" the boy asked.
"You don't never shut up the questions," Mr. Butts cried.
He seized the boy's stick and snapped it.
"Ammonite is in your belly when it's time to eat, lest you sick, and folks say I'm ignorant."
"Oh, appetite," the boy said placidly, and began drawing again, this time with his finger. Well-crafted dialogue will indicate if a character is smart or dumb. Mr. Butts isn't necessarily a moron just because he can't say appetite. We must listen to him a while longer before making up our minds on that score. Honest or dishonest, amusing or an old sobersides. Good dialogue, such as that written by George V. Higgins, Peter Straub, or Graham Greene, is a delight to read. Bad dialogue is deadly. Writers have different skill levels when it comes to dialogue. Your skills in this area can be improved, but as a great man once said, actually it was Clint Eastwood, a man's got to know his limitations. H.P. Lovecraft was a genius when it came to tales of the macabre, but a terrible dialogue writer. He seems to have known it, too, because in the millions of words of fiction he wrote, fewer than 5,000 are dialogue. The following passage from The Color Out of Space, in which a dying farmer describes the alien presence which has invaded his well, showcases Lovecraft's dialogue problems. "Folks, people just don't talk like this, even on their deathbeds." "Nothing. Nothing. The color. It burns. Cold and wet. But it burns. It lived in the well. I seen it. A kind o' smoke. Just like the flowers last spring. The well shone at night. Everything alive. Sucked the life out of everything. In the stone. It must have come in that stone. Pisoned the whole place. Dunno what it wants. That round thing the men from the college dug out in the stone. It was that same color. Just the same. Like the flowers and plants. Seeds. I seen it the first time this week. It beats down your mind and then gets ye, burns ye up. It come from some place whar things ain't as they is here. One o' them professors said so." And so on and so forth in carefully constructed elliptical bursts of information. It's hard to say exactly what's wrong with Lovecraft's dialogue other than the obvious. It's stilted and lifeless, brimming with country cornpone. Some place where things ain't as they is here. When dialogue is right, we know. When it's wrong, we also know. It jags on the air like a badly tuned musical instrument. Lovecraft was, by all accounts, both snobbish and painfully shy, a galloping racist as well, his stories full of sinister Africans and the sort of scheming Jews my Uncle Orrin always worried about after 4 or 5 beers. The kind of writer who maintains a voluminous correspondence but gets along poorly with others in person. Were he alive today, he'd likely exist most vibrantly in various internet chat rooms. Dialogue is a skill best learned by people who enjoy talking and listening to others, particularly listening, picking up the accents, rhythms, dialect, and slang of various groups. Loners such as Lovecraft often write it badly, or with the care of someone who is composing in a language other than his or her native tongue. I don't know if contemporary novelist John Katzenbach is a loner or not, but his novel Heart's War contains some memorably bad dialogue. Katzenbach is the sort of novelist who drives creative writing teachers mad, a wonderful storyteller whose art is marred by self-repetition, a fault which is curable, and an ear for talk that is pure tin, a fault which probably isn't. Heart's War is a murder mystery set in a World War II POW camp. A neat idea, but problematic in Katzenbach's hands once he really gets the pot boiling. Here is Wing Commander Philip Price talking to his friends just before the Germans, in charge of Stalag Luft 13, take him away, not to be repatriated as they claim, but probably to be shot in the woods. Price grabbed at Tommy once again. "Tommy," he whispered. "This is not a coincidence. Nothing is what it seems. Dig deeper. Save him, lad. Save him. For more than ever now, I believe Scott is innocent. You're on your own now, boys. And remember, I'm counting on you to live through this. Survive, whatever happens." He turned back to the Germans. "All right, Hauptmann," he said with a sudden, exceedingly calm determination. "I'm ready now. Do with me what you will." Either Katzenbach does not realize that every line of the Wing Commander's dialogue is a cliché from a late 40s war movie, or he's trying to use that similarity deliberately to awaken feelings of pity, sadness, and perhaps nostalgia in his audience. Either way, it doesn't work. The only feeling the passage evokes is a kind of impatient incredulity. You wonder if any editor ever saw it, and if so, what stayed his or her blue pencil? Given Katzenbach's considerable talents in other areas, his failure here tends to reinforce my idea that writing good dialogue is art as well as craft. Many good dialogue writers simply seem to have been born with a well-tuned ear, just as some musicians and singers have perfect or near-perfect pitch. Here's a passage from Elmore Leonard's novel, Be Cool. You might compare it to the Lovecraft and Katzenbach passages above, noting first of all that here we've got an honest-to-God exchange going on and not a stilted soliloquy. Chili looked up again as Tommy said, "You doing okay?"
"You want to know if I'm making out?"
"I mean in your business. How's it going? I know you did okay with Get Leo, a terrific picture, terrific. And you know what else? It was good. But the sequel, what was it called?"
"Get Lost."
"Yeah. Well, that's what happened before I got a chance to see it. It disappeared."
"It didn't open big, so the studio walked away. I was against doing a sequel to begin with, but the guy running production at Tower says they're making the picture, with me or without me. I thought, well, if I can come up with a good story."
Two guys at lunch in Beverly Hills, and right away we know they're both players. They may be phonies, and maybe they're not, but they're an instant buy within the context of Leonard's story. In fact, we welcome them with open arms. Their talk is so real that part of what we feel is the guilty pleasure of anyone first tuning in and then eavesdropping on an interesting conversation. We're getting a sense of character as well, although only in faint strokes. This is early on in the novel, page 2, actually, and Leonard is an old pro. He knows he doesn't have to do it all at once. Still, don't we learn something about Tommy's character when he assures Chili that Get Leo is not only terrific, but also good? We could ask ourselves if such dialogue is true to life, or only to a certain idea of life, a certain stereotyped image of Hollywood players, Hollywood lunches, Hollywood deals. This is a fair enough question, and the answer is perhaps not. Yet the dialogue does ring true to our ear. At his best, and although Be Cool is quite entertaining, it is far from Leonard's best, Elmore Leonard is capable of a kind of street poetry. The skill necessary to write such dialogue comes from years of practice. The art comes from a creative imagination, which is working hard and having fun. As with all other aspects of fiction, the key to writing good dialogue is honesty. And if you are honest about the words coming out of your characters' mouths, you'll find that you've let yourself in for a fair amount of criticism. Not a week goes by that I don't receive at least one pissed-off letter, most weeks there are more than one, accusing me of being foul-mouthed, bigoted, homophobic, murderous, frivolous, or downright psychopathic. In the majority of cases, what my correspondents are hot under the collar about relates to something in the dialogue. Let's get the fuck out of Dodge. Or, we don't cotton much to niggers around here. Or, what do you think you're doing, you fucking faggot? My mother, God rest her, didn't approve of profanity or any such talk. She called it the language of the ignorant. This did not, however, keep her from yelling, "Oh, shit!" if she burned the roast or nailed her thumb a good one while hammering a picture hook into the wall. Nor does it preclude most people, Christian as well as heathen, from saying something similar, or even stronger, when the dog barfs on the shag carpet or the car slips off the jack. It's important to tell the truth. So much depends upon it, as William Carlos Williams almost said when he was writing about that red wheelbarrow. The Legion of Decency might not like the word shit, and you might not like it much either, but sometimes you're just stuck with it. No kid ever ran to his mother and said that his little sister had just defecated in the tub. I suppose he might say pushed or went woo-woo, but took a shit is, I fear, very much in the ballpark. Little pitchers have big ears, after all. You must tell the truth if your dialogue is to have the resonance and realism that Heart's War, good story though it is, so sadly lacks. And that holds true all the way down to what folks say when they hit their thumb with the hammer. If you substitute, "Oh, sugar," for "Oh, shit," because you're thinking about the Legion of Decency, you are breaking the unspoken contract that exists between writer and reader. Your promise to express the truth of how people act and talk through the medium of a made-up story. On the other hand, one of your characters, the protagonist's old maid aunt, for instance, really might say, "Oh, sugar," instead of "Oh, shit," after pounding her thumb with a hammer. You'll know which to use if you know your character, and we'll learn something about the speaker that will make him or her more vivid and interesting. The point is to let each character speak freely, without regard to what the Legion of Decency or the Christian Ladies Reading Circle may approve of. To do otherwise would be cowardly as well as dishonest, and believe me, writing fiction in America as we enter the 21st century is no job for intellectual cowards. There are lots of would-be censors out there, and although they may have different agendas, they all want basically the same thing, for you to see the world they see, or to at least shut up about what you do see that's different. They are agents of the status quo. Not necessarily bad guys, but dangerous guys if you happen to believe in intellectual freedom. As it happens, I agree with my mother. Profanity and vulgarity is the language of the ignorant and the verbally challenged. Mostly, that is. There are exceptions, including profane aphorisms of great color and vitality. They always fuck you at the drive-thru. I'm busier than a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. Wish in one hand, shit in the other, see which one fills up first. These phrases, and others like them, aren't for the drawing room, but they are striking and pungent. Or consider this passage from Brainstorm by Richard Dooling, where vulgarity becomes poetry. Exhibit A, one loutish, headstrong penis, a barbarous cuntivore without a fly speck of decency in him. The capscallion of all rapscallions, a scurvy, vermiform scug with a serpentine twinkle in his solitary eye. An orgulous Turk who strikes in the dark vaults of flesh like a penile thunderbolt. A greedy cur seeking shadows, slick crevices, tuna fish ecstasy, and sleep. Although not offered as dialogue, I want to reproduce another passage from Dueling here, because it speaks to the converse, that one can be quite admirably graphic without resorting to vulgarity or profanity at all. She straddled him and prepared to make the necessary port connections, male and female adapters ready, I.O. enabled, server client, master slave. Just a couple of high-end biological machines preparing to hot dock with cable modems and access each other's front-end processors. If I were a Henry James or Jane Austen sort of guy, writing only about tops or smart college folks, I'd hardly ever have to use a dirty word or a profane phrase. I might never have had a book banned from America's school libraries or gotten a letter from some helpful fundamentalist fellow who wants me to know that I'm going to burn in hell where all my millions of dollars won't buy me so much as a single drink of water. I did not, however, grow up among folks of that sort. I grew up as a part of America's lower middle class, and they're the people I can write about with the most honesty and knowledge. It means that they say shit more often than sugar when they bang their thumbs, but I've made my peace with that, was never much at war with it in the first place, as a matter of fact. When I get one of those letters, or face another review that accuses me of being a vulgar lowbrow, which to some extent I am, I take comfort from the words of turn-of-the-century social realist Frank Norris, whose novels include The Octopus, The Pit, and McTeague, an authentically great book. Norris wrote about working-class guys on ranches, in city laboring jobs, in factories. McTeague, the main character of Norris's finest work, is an unschooled dentist. Norris's books provoked a good deal of public outrage, to which Norris responded coolly and disdainfully. What do I care for their opinions? I never truckled. I told them the truth. Some people don't want to hear the truth, of course, but that's not your problem. What would be is wanting to be a writer without wanting to shoot straight. Talk, whether ugly or beautiful, is an index of character. It can also be a breath of cool, refreshing air in a room some people would prefer to keep shut up. In the end, the important question has nothing to do with whether the talk in your story is sacred or profane. The only question is how it rings on the page and in the ear. If you expect it to ring true, then you must talk yourself. Even more important, you must shut up and listen to others talk. Everything I've said about dialogue applies to building characters in fiction. The job boils down to two things: paying attention to how the real people around you behave, and then telling the truth about what you see. You may notice that your next-door neighbor picks his nose when he thinks no one is looking. This is a great detail, but noting it does you no good as a writer unless you're willing to dump it into a story at some point. Are fictional characters drawn directly from life? Obviously not, at least on a one-to-one basis. You'd better not, unless you want to get sued or shot on your way to the mailbox some fine morning. In many cases, such as Romana Clef novels like Valley of the Dolls, characters are drawn mostly from life. But after readers get done playing the inevitable guessing game about who's who, these stories tend to be unsatisfying, stuffed with shadowbox celebrities who bonk each other and then fade quickly from the reader's mind. I read Valley of the Dolls shortly after it came out. I was a cook's boy at a Western Maine resort that summer, gobbling it up as eagerly as everyone else who bought it, I suppose, but I can't remember much of what it was about. On the whole, I think I prefer the weekly codswallop served up by the National Enquirer, where I can get recipes and cheesecake photographs, as well as scandal. For me, what happens to characters as a story progresses depends solely on what I discover about them as I go along, how they grow, in other words. Sometimes they grow a little. If they grow a lot, they begin to influence the course of the story instead of the other way around. I almost always start with something that's situational. I don't say that's right, only that it's the way that I've always worked. If a story ends up that same way, however, I count it something of a failure, no matter how interesting it may be to me or to others. I think the best stories always end up being about people rather than the event, which is to say character-driven. Once you get beyond the short story, though, 2 to 4,000 words, let's say, I'm not much of a believer in the so-called character study. I think that, in the end, the story should always be the boss. Hey, if you want a character study, buy a biography or get season tickets to your local college's theater lab productions. You'll get all the character you can stand. It's also important to remember that no one is the bad guy, or the best friend, or the whore with a heart of gold in real life. In real life, we each of us regard ourselves as the main character, the protagonist, the big cheese. The camera is on us, baby. If you can bring this attitude into your fiction, you may not find it easier to create brilliant characters, but it will be harder for you to create the sort of one-dimensional dopes that populate so much pop fiction. Annie Wilkes, the nurse who holds Paul Sheldon prisoner in Misery, may seem psychopathic to us, but it's important to remember that she seems perfectly sane and reasonable to herself, heroic, in fact, a beleaguered woman trying to survive in a hostile world filled with cock-a-doodle brats. We see her go through dangerous mood swings, but I never tried to come right out and say, Annie was depressed and possibly suicidal that day. Or, Annie seemed particularly happy that day. If I have to tell you, I lose. If, on the other hand, I can show you a silent, dirty-haired woman who compulsively gobbles cake and candy, then have you draw the conclusion that Annie is in the depressive part of a manic-depressive cycle, I win. And if I am able, even briefly, to give you a Wilkes-eye view of the world, if I can make you understand her madness, then perhaps I can make her someone you sympathize with or even identify with. The result? She's more frightening than ever because she's close to real. If, on the other hand, I turn her into a cackling old crone, she's just another pop-up bogey lady. In that case, I lose big time, and so does the reader. Who would want to visit with such a stale shrew? That version of Annie was old when The Wizard of Oz was in its first run. It would be fair enough to ask, I suppose, if Paul Sheldon in Misery is me. Certainly parts of him are, but I think you will find that, if you continue to write fiction, every character you create is partly you. When you ask yourself what a certain character will do given a certain set of circumstances, you're making the decision based on what you yourself would, or in the case of a bad guy, wouldn't, do. Added to these versions of yourself are the character traits, both lovely and unlovely, which you observe in others. A guy who picks his nose when he thinks no one is looking, for instance. There is also a wonderful third element, pure blue-sky imagination. This is the part which allowed me to be a psychotic nurse for a little while when I was writing Misery. And being Annie was not, by and large, hard at all. In fact, it was sort of fun. I think being Paul was harder. He was sane, I'm sane, no 4 days at Disneyland there. My novel, The Dead Zone, arose from two questions. Can a political assassin ever be right? And if he is, could you make him the protagonist of a novel, the good guy? These ideas called for a dangerously unstable politician, it seemed to me, a fellow who could climb the political ladder by showing the world a jolly, just-folks face and charming the voters by refusing to play the game in the usual way. Greg Stilson's campaign tactics, as I imagined them 20 years ago, were very similar to the ones Jesse Ventura used in his successful campaign for the governor's seat in Minnesota. Thank goodness Ventura doesn't seem like Stilson in any other ways. The Dead Zone's protagonist, Johnny Smith, is also an everyday, just-folks sort of guy. Only with Johnny, it's no act. The one thing that sets him apart is a limited ability to see the future, gained as the result of a childhood accident. When Johnny shakes Greg Stilson's hand at a political rally, he has a vision of Stilson becoming the President of the United States and subsequently starting World War III. Johnny comes to the conclusion that the only way he can keep this from happening, the only way he can save the world, in other words, is by putting a bullet in Stilson's head. Johnny is different from other violent, paranoid mystics in only one way. He really can see the future. Only, don't they all say that? The situation had an edgy, outlaw feel to it that appealed to me. I thought the story would work if I could make Johnny a genuinely decent guy without turning him into a plaster saint. Same thing with Stilson, only backwards. I wanted him to be authentically nasty and really scare the reader, not just because Stilson is always boiling with potential violence, but because he is so goddamn persuasive. I wanted the reader to constantly be thinking, this guy is out of control. How come somebody can't see through him? The fact that Johnny does see through him would, I thought, put the reader even more firmly in Johnny's corner. When we first meet the potential assassin, he's taking his girl to the county fair, riding the rides and playing the games. What could be more normal or likable? The fact that he's on the verge of proposing to Sarah makes us like him even more. Later, when Sarah suggests they cap a perfect date by sleeping together for the first time, Johnny tells her he wants to wait until they're married. I felt I was walking a fine line on that one. I wanted readers to see Johnny as sincere and sincerely in love, a straight shooter but not a tight-assed prude. I was able to cut his principal behavior a bit by giving him a childish sense of humor. He greets Sarah wearing a glow-in-the-dark Halloween mask. The mask hopefully works in a symbolic way, too. Certainly Johnny is perceived as a monster when he points a gun at candidate Stilson. Same old Johnny, Sarah says, laughing, and by the time the two of them are headed back from the fair in Johnny's old Volkswagen Bug, I think Johnny Smith has become our friend, just an average American guy who's hoping to live happily ever after. The sort of guy who'd return your wallet with the money still in it if he found it on the street, or stop and help you change your flat tire if he came upon you broke down by the side of the road. Ever since John F. Kennedy was shot in Dallas, the great American bogeyman has been the guy with the rifle in a high place. I wanted to make this guy into the reader's friend. Johnny was hard. Taking an average guy and making him vivid and interesting always is. Greg Stilson, like most villains, was easier and a lot more fun. I wanted to nail his dangerous, divided character in the first scene of the book. Here, several years before he runs for the U.S. House of Representatives in New Hampshire, Stilson is a young traveling salesman hawking Bibles to Midwest country folk. When he stops at one farm, he is menaced by a snarling dog. Stilson remains friendly and smiling, Mr. Jess Folks, until he's positive no one's home at the farm. Then he sprays tear gas in the dog's eyes and kicks it to death. If one is to measure success by reader response, the opening scene of The Dead Zone, my first number one hardcover bestseller, was one of my most successful ever. Certainly it struck a raw nerve. I was deluged with letters, most of them protesting my outrageous cruelty to animals. I wrote back to these folks, pointing out the usual things. A, Greg Stilson wasn't real. B, the dog wasn't real. C, I myself had never in my life put the boot to one of my pets or anyone else's. I also pointed out what might have been a little less obvious. It was important to establish right up front that Gregory Amos Stilson was an extremely dangerous man and very good at camouflage. I continued to build the characters of Johnny and Greg in alternating scenes until the confrontation at the end of the book, when things resolved themselves in what I hoped would be an unexpected way. The characters of my protagonist and antagonist were determined by the story I had to tell, by the fossil, the found object, in other words. My job, and yours if you decide this is a viable approach to storytelling, is to make sure these fictional folks behave in ways that will both help the story and seem reasonable to us, given what we know about them and what we know about real life, of course. Sometimes villains feel self-doubt, as Greg Stilson does. Sometimes they feel pity, as Annie Wilkes does. And sometimes the good guy tries to turn away from doing the right thing, as Johnny Smith does, as Jesus Christ himself did, if you think about that prayer, "Take this cup from my lips," in the Garden of Gethsemane. And if you do your job, your characters will come to life and start doing stuff on their own. I know that sounds a little creepy if you haven't actually experienced it, but it's terrific fun when it happens, and it will solve a lot of your problems, believe me. We've covered some basic aspects of good storytelling, all of which return to the same core ideas, that practice is invaluable and should feel good, really, not like practice at all, and that honesty is indispensable. Skills in description, dialogue, and character development all boil down to seeing or hearing clearly and then transcribing what you see or hear with equal clarity and without using a lot of tiresome, unnecessary adverbs. There are lots of bells and whistles, too. Onomatopoeia, incremental repetition, stream of consciousness, interior dialogue, changes of verbal tense. It has become quite fashionable to tell stories, especially shorter ones in the present tense. The sticky question of backstory, how do you get it in and how much of it belongs? Theme, pacing, we'll touch on these last two, and a dozen other topics, all of which are covered, sometimes at exhausting length, in writing courses and standard writing texts. My take on all these things is pretty simple. It's all on the table, every bit of it, and you should use anything that improves the quality of your writing and doesn't get in the way of your story. If you like an alliterative phrase, the knights of nowhere battling the nabobs of nullity, by all means, throw it in and see how it looks on paper. If it seems to work, it can stay. If it doesn't, and to me this one sounds pretty bad, like Spiro Agnew crossed with Robert Jordan, well, that delete key is on your machine for a good reason. There is absolutely no need to be hidebound and conservative in your work, just as you are under no obligation to write experimental, nonlinear prose because the Village Voice or the New York Review of Books says the novel is dead. Both the traditional and the modern are available to you. Shit, write upside down if you want to, or do it in Crayola pictographs. But no matter how you do it, there comes a point when you must judge what you've written and how well you wrote it. I don't believe a story or a novel should be allowed outside the door of your study or writing room unless you feel confident that it's reasonably reader-friendly. You can't please all the readers all of the time. You can't please even some of the readers all of the time. But you really ought to try to please at least some of the readers some of the time. I think William Shakespeare said that. And now that I've waved that caution flag, duly satisfying all OSHA, Mensa, NASA, and Writers Guild guidelines, let me reiterate that it's all on the table, all up for grabs. Isn't that an intoxicating thought? I think it is. Try any goddamn thing you like, no matter how boringly normal or outrageous. If it works, fine. If it doesn't, toss it. Toss it even if you love it. Hemingway once said, "You must kill your darlings," and he was right. I most often see chances to add the grace notes and ornamental touches after my basic storytelling job is done. Once in a while, it comes earlier, not long after I began The Green Mile and realized my main character was an innocent man likely to be executed for the crime of another. I decided to give him the initials J.C. after the most famous innocent man of all time. I first saw this done in Light in August, still my favorite Faulkner novel, where the sacrificial lamb is named Joe Christmas. Thus, death row inmate John Bowes became John Coffey. I wasn't sure, right up to the end of the book, if my J.C. would live or die. I wanted him to live because I liked and pitied him, but I figured those initials couldn't hurt, one way or the other. Mostly, I don't see stuff like that until the story's done. Once it is, I'm able to kick back, read over what I've written, and look for underlying patterns. If I see some, and I almost always do, I can work at bringing them out in a second, more fully realized draft of the story. Two examples of the sort of work second drafts were made for are symbolism and theme. If in school you ever studied the symbolism of the color white in Moby Dick, or Hawthorne's symbolic use of the forest in such stories as Young Goodman Brown, and came away from those classes feeling like a stupidnik, you may even now be backing off with your hands raised protectively in front of you, shaking your head and saying, "Gee, no, thanks, I gave it the office." But wait. Symbolism doesn't have to be difficult and relentlessly brainy, nor does it have to be consciously crafted as a kind of ornamental Turkish rug upon which the furniture of the story stands. If you can go along with the concept of the story as a pre-existing thing, a fossil in the ground, then symbolism must also be pre-existing, right? Just another bone or set of them in your new discovery. That's if it's there. If it isn't, so what? You still got the story itself, don't you? If it is there, and if you notice it, I think you should bring it out as well as you can, polishing it until it shines, and then cutting it the way a jeweler would cut a precious or semi-precious stone. Carrie, as I've already noted, is a short novel about a picked-on girl who discovers a telekinetic ability within herself. She can move objects by thinking about them. To atone for a vicious shower room prank in which she has participated, Carrie's classmate, Susan Snell, persuades her boyfriend to invite Carrie to the senior prom. They are elected king and queen. During the celebration, another of Carrie's classmates, the unpleasant Christine Hargensen, pulls a second prank on Carrie, this one deadly. Carrie takes her revenge by using her telekinetic power to kill most of her classmates and her atrocious mother before dying herself. That's the whole deal, really. It's as simple as a fairy tale. There was no need to mess it up with bells and whistles, although I did add a number of epistolary interludes, passages from fictional books, a diary entry, letters, teletype bulletins, between narrative segments. This was partly to inject a greater sense of realism. I was thinking of Orson Welles's radio adaptation of War of the Worlds, but mostly because the first draft of the book was so damned short it barely seemed like a novel. When I read Carrie over prior to starting the second draft, I noticed there was blood at all three crucial points of the story, beginning, Carrie's paranormal ability is apparently brought on by her first menstrual period, climax, the prank which sets Carrie off at the prom involves a bucket of pig's blood for a pig, Chris Hargensen tells her boyfriend, and end. Sue Snell, the girl who tries to help Carrie, discovers she is not pregnant, as she had half hoped and half feared when she gets her own period. There's plenty of blood in most horror stories, of course. It is our stock in trade, you might say. Still, the blood in Carrie seemed more than just splatter to me. It seemed to mean something. That meaning wasn't consciously created, however. While writing Carrie, I never once stopped to think, ah, all this blood symbolism will win me brownie points with the critics. Or, boy, oh boy, this should certainly get me in a college bookstore or two. For one thing, a writer would have to be a lot crazier than I am to think of Carrie as anyone's intellectual treat. Intellectual treat or not, the significance of all that blood was hard to miss once I started reading over my beer and tea-splattered first draft manuscript. So I started to play with the idea, image, and emotional connotations of blood, trying to think of as many associations as I could. There were lots, most of them pretty heavy. Blood is strongly linked to the idea of sacrifice. For young women, it's associated with reaching physical maturity and the ability to bear children. In the Christian religion, plenty of others as well, it's symbolic of both sin and salvation. Finally, it is associated with the handing down of family traits and talents. We are said to look like this or behave like that because it's in our blood. We know this isn't very scientific, that those things are really in our genes and DNA patterns, but we use the one to summarize the other. It is that ability to summarize and encapsulate that makes symbolism so interesting, useful, and, when used well, arresting. You could argue that it's really just another kind of figurative language. Does that make it necessary to the success of your story or novel? Indeed not, and it can actually hurt, especially if you get carried away. Symbolism exists to adorn and enrich, not to create a sense of artificial profundity. None of the bells and whistles are about story, all right? Only story is about story. Are you tired of hearing that yet? I hope not, because I'm not even close to getting tired of saying it. Symbolism, and the other adornments too, does serve a useful purpose, though. It's more than just chrome on the grill. It can serve as a focusing device for both you and your reader, helping to create a more unified and pleasing work. I think that when you read your manuscript over and when you talk it over, you'll see if symbolism or the potential for it exists. If it doesn't, leave well enough alone. If it does, however, if it's clearly a part of the fossil you're working to unearth, go for it. Enhance it. You're a monkey if you don't. The same things are true of theme. Writing in literature classes can be annoyingly preoccupied by and pretentious about theme, approaching it as the most sacred of sacred cows, but don't be shocked. It's really no big deal. If you write a novel, spend weeks and then months catching it word by word, you owe it both to the book and to yourself to lean back or take a long walk when you've finished and ask yourself why you bothered, why you spent all that time, why it seemed so important. In other words, what's it all about, Alfie? When you write a book, you spend day after day scanning and identifying the trees. When you're done, you have to step back and look at the forest. Not every book has to be loaded with symbolism, irony, or musical language. They call it prose for a reason, you know. But it seems to me that every book, at least everyone worth reading, is about something. Your job during or just after the first draft is to decide what something or somethings yours is about. Your job in the second draft, one of them anyway, is to make that something even more clear. This may necessitate some big changes and revisions. The benefits to you and your reader will be clearer focus and a more unified story. It hardly ever fails. The book that took me the longest to write was The Stand. This is also the one my longtime readers still seem to like the best. There's something a little depressing about such a united opinion that you did your best work 20 years ago, but we won't go into that just now, thanks. I finished the first draft about 16 months after I started it. The Stand took an especially long time because it nearly died going into the third turn and heading for home. I'd wanted to write a sprawling, multi-character sort of novel, a fantasy epic if I could manage it, and to that end, I employed a shifting perspective narrative, adding a major character in each chapter of the long first section. Thus, chapter one concerned itself with Stuart Redman, a blue-collar factory worker from Texas. Chapter two first concerned itself with Fran Goldsmith, a pregnant college girl from Maine, and then returned to Stu. Chapter three began with Larry Underwood, a rock and roll singer in New York, before going back first to Fran, then to Stu Redman again. My plan was to link all these characters, the good, the bad, and the ugly, in two places, Boulder and Las Vegas. I thought they'd probably end up going to war against one another. The first half of the book also told the story of a man-made virus which sweeps America and the world, wiping out 99% of the human race and utterly destroying our technology-based culture. I was writing this story near the end of the so-called energy crisis in the 1970s, and I had an absolutely marvelous time envisioning a world that went smash during the course of one horrified, infected summer. Really not much more than a month. The view was panoramic, detailed, nationwide, and, to me at least, breathtaking. Rarely have I seen so clearly with the eye of my imagination, from the traffic jam plugging the dead tube of New York's Lincoln Tunnel to the sinister, Nazi-ish rebirth of Las Vegas under the watchful and often amused red eye of Randall Flagg. All this sounds terrible, is terrible, but to me, the vision was also strangely optimistic. No more energy crisis, for one thing. No more famine. No more massacres in Uganda. No more acid rain or hole in the ozone layer. Finito as well to saber-rattling nuclear superpowers, and certainly no more overpopulation. Instead, there was a chance for humanity's remaining shred to start over again in a God-centered world to which miracles, magic, and prophecy had returned. I liked my story. I liked my characters. And still, there came a point when I couldn't write any longer because I didn't know what to write. Like Pilgrim in John Bunyan's epic, I had come to a place where the straight way was lost. I wasn't the first writer to discover this awful place, and I'm a long way from being the last. This is the land of writer's block. If I'd had 200 or even 300 pages of single-space manuscript instead of more than 500, I think I would have abandoned the stand and gone on to something else. God knows I had done it before. But 500 pages was too great an investment, both in time and in creative energy. I found it impossible to let go. Also, there was this little voice whispering to me that the book was really good, and if I didn't finish, I would regret it forever. So instead of moving on to another project, I started taking long walks, a habit which would, 2 decades later, get me in a lot of trouble. I took a book or magazine on these walks, but rarely opened it, no matter how bored I felt, looking at the same old trees and the same old chattering, ill-natured jays and squirrels. Boredom can be a very good thing for someone in a creative jam. I spent those walks being bored and thinking about my gigantic boondoggle of a manuscript. For weeks, I got exactly nowhere in my thinking. It all just seemed too hard, too fucking complex. I had run out too many plot lines, and they were in danger of becoming snarled. I circled the problem again and again, beat my fists on it, knocked my head against it. And then, one day when I was thinking of nothing much at all, the answer came to me. It arrived whole and complete, gift-wrapped, you could say, in a single bright flash. I ran home and jotted it down on paper, the only time I've done such a thing, because I was terrified of forgetting. What I saw was that the America in which the stand took place might have been depopulated by the plague, but the world of my story had become dangerously overcrowded, a veritable Calcutta. The solution to where I was stuck, I saw, could be pretty much the same as the situation that got me going, an explosion instead of a plague, but still one quick hard slash of the Gordian knot. I would send the survivors west from Boulder to Las Vegas on a redemptive quest. They would go at once, with no supplies and no plan, like biblical characters seeking a vision or to know the will of God. In Vegas, they would meet Randall Flagg, and good guys and bad guys alike would be forced to make their stand. At one moment, I had none of this. At the next, I had all of it. If there is any one thing I love about writing more than the rest, it's that sudden flash of insight when you see how everything connects. I have heard it called thinking above the curve, and it's that. I've heard it called the overlogic, and it's that too. Whatever you call it, I wrote my page or two of notes in a frenzy of excitement and spent the next 2 or 3 days turning my solution over in my mind, looking for flaws and holes. Also, working out the actual narrative flow, which involved 2 supporting characters placing a bomb in a major character's closet. But that was mostly out of a sense of this is too good to be true unbelief. Too good or not, I knew it was true at the moment of revelation. That bomb in Nick Andros's closet was going to solve all my narrative problems. It did, too. The rest of the book ran itself off in 9 weeks. Later, when my first draft of The Stand was done, I was able to get a better fix on what had stopped me so completely in mid-course. It was a lot easier to think without that voice in the middle of my head constantly yammering, "I'm losing my book! Ah, shit! 500 pages and I'm losing my book! Condition red! Condition red!" I was also able to analyze what got me going again and appreciate the irony of it. I saved my book by blowing approximately half of its major characters to smithereens. There actually ended up being two explosions, the one in Boulder balanced by a similar act of sabotage in Las Vegas. The real source of my malaise, I decided, had been that in the wake of the plague, my Boulder characters, the good guys, were starting up the same old technological death trip. The first hesitant CB broadcasts beckoning people to Boulder would soon lead to TV. Infomercials and 900 numbers would be back in no time. Same deal with the power plants. It certainly didn't take my Boulder folks long to decide that seeking the will of the God who spared them was a lot less important than getting the refrigerators and air conditioners up and running again. In Vegas, Randall Flagg and his friends were learning how to fly jets and bombers, as well as getting the lights back on, but that was okay, to be expected, because they were the bad guys. What had stopped me was realizing, on some level of my mind, that the good guys and bad guys were starting to look perilously alike. And what got me going again was realizing the good guys were worshiping an electronic golden calf and needed a wake-up call, a bomb in the closet, would do just fine. All this suggested to me that violence as a solution is woven through human nature like a damning red thread. That became the theme of The Stand, and I wrote the second draft with it fixed firmly in my mind. Again and again, characters, the bad ones like Lloyd Henreid, as well as the good ones like Stu Redman and Larry Underwood, mention the fact that all that stuff, that is, weapons of mass destruction, is just lying around waiting to be picked up. When the Boulderites propose, innocently, meaning only the best, to rebuild the same old neon Tower of Babel, they are wiped out by more violence. The folks who plant the bomb are doing what Randall Flagg told them to, but Mother Abigail, Flagg's opposite number, says again and again that all things serve God. If this is true, and within the context of The Stand it certainly is, then the bomb is actually a stern message from the guy upstairs, a way of saying, I didn't bring you all this way just so you could start up the same old shit. Near the end of the novel, it was the end of the first, shorter version of the story, Fran asks Stuart Redman if there's any hope at all, if people ever learn from their mistakes. Stu replies, I don't know, and then pauses. In story time, that pause lasts only as long as it takes the reader to flick his or her eye to the last line. In the writer's study, it went on a lot longer. I searched my mind and heart for something else Stu could say, some clarifying statement. I wanted to find it because, at that moment, if at no other, Stu was speaking for me. In the end, however, Stu simply repeats what he has already said. I don't know. It was the best I could do. Sometimes the book gives you answers, but not always, and I didn't want to leave the readers who had followed me through hundreds of pages with nothing but some empty platitude I didn't believe myself. There is no moral to The Stand. No, we'd better learn or we'll probably destroy the whole damn planet next time. But if the theme stands out clearly enough, those discussing it may offer their own morals and conclusions. Nothing wrong with that. Such discussions are one of the great pleasures of the reading life. Although I'd used symbolism, imagery, and literary homage before getting to my novel about the big plague, without Dracula, for instance, I think there is no Salem's Lot, I'm quite sure that I never thought much about theme before getting roadblocked on The Stand. I suppose I thought such things were for better minds and bigger thinkers. I'm not sure I would have gotten to it as soon as I did had I not been desperate to save my story. I was astounded at how really useful thematic thinking turned out to be. It wasn't just a vaporous idea that English professors made you write about on midterm essay exams, discuss the thematic concerns of wise blood in three well-reasoned paragraphs, 30 points, but another handy gadget to keep in the toolbox, this one something like a magnifying glass. Since my revelation on the road concerning the bomb in the closet, I have never hesitated to ask myself, either before starting the second draft of a book or while stuck for an idea in the first draft, just what it is I'm writing about, why I'm spending the time when I could be playing my guitar or riding my motorcycle, what got my nose down to the grindstone in the first place and then kept it there. The answer doesn't always come right away, but there usually is one, and it's usually not too hard to find either. I don't believe any novelist, even one who's written 40-plus books, has too many thematic concerns. I have many interests, but only a few that are deep enough to power novels. These deep interests, I won't quite call them obsessions, include how difficult it is, perhaps impossible, to close Pandora's techno box once it's open. The Stand, the Tommyknockers, Firestarter. The question of why, if there is a God, such terrible things happen. The Stand, Desperation, The Green Mile. The thin line between reality and fantasy. The Dark Half, Bag of Bones, The Drawing of the Three. And most of all, the terrible attraction violence sometimes has for fundamentally good people. The Shining, The Dark Half. I've also written again and again about the fundamental differences between children and adults and about the healing power of the human imagination. And I repeat, no big deal. These are just interests which have grown out of my life and thought, out of my experiences as a boy and a man, out of my roles as a husband, a father, a writer, and a lover. They are questions that occupy my mind when I turn out the lights for the night and I'm alone with myself, looking up into the darkness with one hand tucked beneath the pillow. You undoubtedly have your own thoughts, interests, and concerns, and they have arisen, as mine have, from your experiences and adventures as a human being. Some are likely similar to those I've mentioned above, and some are likely very different, but you have them, and you should use them in your work. That's not all those ideas are there for, perhaps, but surely it's one of the things they are good for. I should close this little sermonette with a word of warning. Starting with the questions and thematic concerns is a recipe for bad fiction. Good fiction always begins with story and progresses to theme. It almost never begins with theme and progresses to story. The only possible exceptions to this rule that I can think of are allegories like George Orwell's Animal Farm, and I have a sneaking suspicion that with Animal Farm, the story idea may indeed have come first. If I see Orwell in the afterlife, I mean to ask him. But once your basic story is on paper, you need to think about what it means and enrich your following drafts with your conclusions. To do less is to rob your work and, eventually, your readers of the vision that makes each tale you write uniquely your own. So far, so good. Now let's talk about revising the work. How much and how many drafts? For me, the answer has always been 2 drafts and a polish. With the advent of word processing technology, my polishes have become closer to a 3rd draft. You should realize that I'm only talking about my own personal mode of writing here. In actual practice, rewriting varies greatly from writer to writer. Kurt Vonnegut, for example, rewrote each page of his novels until he got them exactly the way he wanted them. The result was days when he might only manage a page or two of finished copy, and the wastebasket would be full of crumpled, rejected page 71s and 72s. But when the manuscript was finished, the book was finished, by gum. You could set it in type. Yet I think certain things hold true for most writers, and those are the ones I want to talk about now. If you've been writing a while, you won't need me to help you much with this part. You'll have your own established routine. If you're a beginner, though, let me urge that you take your story through at least 2 drafts, the one you do with the study door closed and the one you do with it open. With the door shut, downloading what's in my head directly to the page, I write as fast as I can and still remain comfortable. Writing fiction, especially a long work of fiction, can be a difficult, lonely job. It's like crossing the Atlantic Ocean in a bathtub. There's plenty of opportunity for self-doubt. If I write rapidly, putting down my story exactly as it comes into my mind, only looking back to check the names of my characters and the relevant parts of their backstories, I find that I can keep up with my original enthusiasm and at the same time outrun the self-doubt that's always waiting to settle in. This first draft, the all-story draft, should be written with no help or interference from anyone else. There may come a point when you want to show what you're doing to a close friend. Very often the close friend you think of first is the one who shares your bed, either because you're proud of what you're doing or because you're doubtful about it. My best advice is to resist this impulse. Keep the pressure on. Don't lower it by exposing what you've written to the doubt, the praise, or even the well-meaning questions of someone from the outside world. Let your hope of success and your fear of failure carry you on, difficult as that may be. There'll be time to show off what you've done when you finish, but even after finishing, I think you must be cautious and give yourself a chance to think while the story is still like a field of freshly fallen snow, absent of any tracks save your own. The great thing about writing with the door shut is that you find yourself forced to concentrate on story to the exclusion of practically everything else. No one can ask you, "What were you trying to express with Garfield's dying words?" Or, "What's the significance of the green dress?" You may not have been trying to express anything with Garfield's dying words, and Maura could be wearing green only because that's what you saw when she came into sight in your mind's eye. On the other hand, perhaps those things do mean something, or will, when you get a chance to look at the forest instead of the trees. Either way, the first draft is the wrong place to think about it. Here's something else. If no one says to you, "Oh, Sam," or "Amy, this is wonderful," you are a lot less apt to slack off or to start concentrating on the wrong thing. Being wonderful, for instance, instead of telling the goddamn story. Now let's say you finished your first draft. Congratulations. Good job. Have a glass of champagne. Send out for a pizza. Do whatever it is you do when you've got something to celebrate. If you have someone who has been impatiently waiting to read your novel, a spouse, let's say, someone who has perhaps been working 9 to 5 and helping to pay the bills while you chase your dream, then this is the time to give up the goods. If, that is, your first reader or readers will promise not to talk to you about the book until you are ready to talk to them about it. This may sound a little high-handed, but it's really not. You've done a lot of work, and you need a period of time, how much or how little depends on the individual writer, to rest. Your mind and imagination, two things which are related but not really the same, have to recycle themselves, at least in regard to this one particular work. My advice is that you take a couple of days off, go fishing, go kayaking, do a jigsaw puzzle, and then go to work on something else, something shorter preferably, and something that's a complete change of direction and pace from your newly finished book. I wrote some pretty good novellas, The Body and Apt Pupil among them, between drafts of longer works like The Dead Zone and The Dark Half. How long you'll let your book rest, sort of like bread dough between kneadings, is entirely up to you, but I think it should be a minimum of 6 weeks. During this time, your manuscript will be safely shut away in a desk drawer, aging and, one hopes, mellowing. Your thoughts will turn to it frequently, and you'll likely be tempted a dozen times or more to take it out, if only to reread some passage that seems particularly fine in your memory, something you'd like to go back to so you can re-experience what a really exciting writer you are. Resist temptation. If you don't, you'll very likely decide you didn't do as well on that passage as you thought, and you'd better retool it on the spot. This is bad. The only thing worse would be for you to decide the passage is even better than you remembered. Why not drop everything and read the whole book over right then? Get back to work on it. Hell, you're ready. You're fucking Shakespeare. You're not, though. And you're not ready to go back to the old project until you've gotten so involved in a new one, or re-involved in your day-to-day life, that you've almost forgotten the unreal estate that took up 3 hours of your every morning or afternoon for a period of 3 or 5 or 7 months. When you come to the correct evening, which you may well have marked on your office calendar, take your manuscript out of the drawer. If it looks like an alien relic bought at a junk shop or a yard sale where you can hardly remember stopping, you're ready. Sit down with your door shut. You will be opening it to the world soon enough. A pencil in your hand and a legal pad by your side. Then, read your manuscript over. Do it all in one sitting, if that's possible. It won't be, of course, if your book is a 400 or 500-pager. Make all the notes you want, but concentrate on the mundane housekeeping jobs, like fixing misspellings and picking up inconsistencies. There'll be plenty. Only God gets it right the first time, and only a slob says, "Oh, well, let it go. That's what copy editors are for." If you've never done it before, you'll find reading your book over after a 6-week layoff to be a strange, often exhilarating experience. It's yours. You'll recognize it as yours, even be able to remember what tune was on the stereo when you wrote certain lines. And yet, it will also be like reading the work of someone else, a soul twin, perhaps. This is the way it should be, the reason you waited. It's always easier to kill someone else's darlings than it is to kill your own. With 6 weeks' worth of recuperation time, you'll also be able to see any glaring holes in the plot or character development. I'm talking about holes big enough to drive a truck through. It's amazing how some of these things can elude the writer while he or she is occupied with the daily work of composition. And listen, if you spot a few of these big holes, you are forbidden to feel depressed about them or to beat up on yourself. Screw-ups happen to the best of us. There's a story that the architect of the Flatiron Building committed suicide when he realized just before the ribbon-cutting ceremony that he had neglected to put any men's rooms in his prototypical skyscraper. Probably not true, but remember this, someone really did design the Titanic and then label it unsinkable. For me, the most glaring errors I find on the reread have to do with character motivation, related to character development, but not quite the same. I'll smack myself upside the head with the heel of my palm, then grab my legal pad and write something like, "Page 91. Sandy Hunter filches a buck from Shirley's stash in the dispatch office." Why? God's sake, Sandy would never do anything like this. I also mark the page in the manuscript with a big cross-out symbol, meaning that cuts and/or changes are needed on this page, and reminding myself to check my notes for the exact details if I don't remember them. I love this part of the process. Well, I love all parts of the process, but this one is especially nice, because I'm rediscovering my own book and usually liking it. That changes. By the time a book is actually in print, I've been over it a dozen times or more, can quote whole passages, and only wish the damned old smelly thing would go away. That's later, though. The first read-through is usually pretty fine.